Welcome to the Poundcast, the Digital Pound Foundation's podcast dedicated to explaining and discussing all aspects of a digital pound and the impact of new forms of digital money. Your host is Jan Apache, Policy Lead and Executive Director of the Digital Pound Foundation. Today, Jana is joined by Rami Solomon, President at GMO Trust, a New York-regulated stablecoin issuer and co-founder of the Stablecoin Standard. Rami discusses his journey into the world of stablecoins and his interest in the space, and shares his experience working in the foreign exchange and prime brokerage industry before being drawn to the transformative potential of stablecoins.
Welcome, Rami. I'm really glad to have you here today speaking with us. You're doing some fascinating work in the world of stablecoins, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it.
Thank you, Jana. Very nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. And looking forward to the conversation.
So tell us a bit about yourself to start off with. What led you to the world of stablecoins, and what is your interest in the space?
So it's a good question. So I've been in TradFi over 20 years, a variety of brokerages and investment banks, and spent at least sort of 5 to 10 years in foreign exchange and prime brokerage across Citibank and a couple of other large brokerages, and setting up my own brokerage as well. So I've been very familiar with the FX space, and I found myself working for a Japanese company, GMO, in London, running an agency FX business. And at the time, I recognized that they actually had a crypto vertical brokerage in Japan, and they had this business out in New York issuing stablecoins. So I found myself in sort of the interesting pandemic time, finding out a bit more about what they were doing, and found myself more drawn to the business that they were doing. I felt that it was transformational technology. It was really interesting. And the opportunity came about that I could join their business. And I've been here for nearly 2 years now.
That's a fascinating journey to the world of stablecoins. And, you know, having come from a TradFi background myself, it's definitely a very interesting space with a lot of potential. But let's start off with the definition of a stablecoin. So what is a stablecoin?
Well, it's a really good question. It's starting to get more clarity as regulators around the world start to answer the same question. I think at this most simplistic side, a stablecoin is a cryptocurrency where that cryptocurrency's value is pegged, referenced, attached to, mimics another asset. So, you know, it can be a fiat currency, it could be gold, it could be some other asset, but it's a real world asset that generally this cryptocurrency's value should be based on and reflect the value of that underlying asset. So in Europe, MiCA defines stablecoins as asset referenced tokens or e-money tokens. So those are the two sort of definitions that they have for it, which is pretty clear. So it's an asset reference token. I think that's probably a nice easy way of describing it. Where that token is the US dollar or pound sterling or Japanese yen or gold.
And I think that's a really interesting distinction to be made between the assets that the token references and the way that the token is backed, right? Because you can have a stablecoin that references GBP or Euro or USD, for example, but it's backed by other assets that are not necessarily that underlying currency or that underlying commodity itself.
Yes. And I think in that sense, some of it almost mimics money market products. You know, it's where it's a product that has a par value, but you know, the products that make up the reserve pool are not necessarily that product. You know, it could be, you know, in many dollar stablecoin examples, it could be an element of cash held at banks, and then an element of T-bills or treasuries or other products that sort of reference the dollar, but not necessarily are the dollar, can come into that reserve pool. And I think I didn't throw in the example also that, you know, there are algorithmic stablecoins as well, which sounds a bit like an oxymoron, but it isn't. It is where there's the price stability of the cryptocurrency is held by an algorithm as well. So that's something we can cover, but what I was describing before are sort of traditional like say traditional, we're in a nascent industry, so nothing's really traditional because nothing's old. But, you know, fiat-backed stablecoins are generally the stablecoins that we're discussing, that I interact with, that I represent. Yeah.
And what need or needs do stablecoins fulfill in the market? What can we do with them that we can't do with other forms of money, or that we can't do indeed with other of the kind of more native cryptocurrencies like Coin or ETH, for example, today?
Yes, yeah, so it's a good question. And I guess the one thing to say at the outset is that stablecoins predominantly live and are traded within the crypto ecosystem. So they were created, designed to mitigate price volatility in crypto for people in the crypto community. So if you're trading Bitcoin, ETH, and many of the other coins where there's a lot of price volatility, and you had made your winnings or wanted to mitigate your losses, but you didn't want to stay outside of the crypto trading ecosystem and get back into cash, you wanted to get into another cryptocurrency that allowed you 24/7 access to the crypto infrastructure without having to subject yourself to price volatility of volatile assets like Bitcoin, like ETH and the others. You would get into a cryptocurrency that was pegged to something that you understood in the real world. So generically, things went into dollar, and therefore, you know, the proliferation of dollar stablecoins became very, very, very widely held because people understood that that was an anchor reference in a currency that everyone understood the value of, and therefore it was easy then for people to say, right, I'm going to stay in crypto. I'm ready to use that asset to then, you know, trade into DeFi, trade into this cryptocurrency, in and out. But I know that actually my anchor, I'm holding a digital representation of something that I know in the real world is a dollar. And that was sort of the rationale behind it. In terms of answering the question around what can it do that current forms of money can't do, I guess the answer is that it allows you to transfer with ultimate finality in a very quick time. So, you know, one of the game-changing concepts, having come from sort of TradFi and foreign exchange, where everything is settled on a T+1 or a T+2 basis. So you do a trade, but actually nothing settles until two business days afterwards. Going to a stablecoin where there's actually absolute transfer of value on a T0 basis, atomic. So depending on the blockchain, whether it's Ethereum or some other quicker networks out there, it can be seconds for me to transfer to you, Jen, if I had, you know, we both had a wallet and a MetaMask and just transfer each other some funds. We can do it with absolute certainty outside of the banking system, a transfer of wealth and value within, you know, seconds. That's very, very different to what's there in the current landscape in financial services. So that's why it's such a game changer. And that's why we're seeing some of the larger institutions, whether it be banks looking at CBDCs, or whether it's private money, so digital tokenized deposits, or banks looking at different sort of ways, JP Morgan and Citi in the last few weeks doing this kind of stuff, because this technology is a bit of a game changer. This is quicker than the current rails that are out there. So if you want to transfer value quickly, you can do so with using this new infrastructure, this new ledger, as it were, and you can do it with certainty, with finality, and you get away from issues like Hurstadt risk. So Hurstadt risk is a risk where you are relying on the banking settlement network, and what happens if that bank collapses? You know, Hurstadt Bank was a bank in the 80s that collapsed, but it showed that you still had settlement risk towards an institution. Institutions like CLS have come up in between to sort of mitigate that risk and the sort of clearing. Yeah. But this is a new framework, a new technology that maybe takes the game on. And that's the advantage, I think. That's what's very exciting about this. And it opens up a world of possibilities. So there's the advantage for people who are unbanked. So, you know, Latin America, lots of people have a mobile phone. Not many people have a bank account. And they also live in extremely high inflation countries where their currencies are not really that good as a store of value. So they're able to...
We currently live in a high inflation
country as well. It's not applied to to various degrees. But it shows that, you know, if you get your paycheck in Argentinian peso, you know you're losing 10% a month. It's 110% a year. So one of the first things you can do in a country like that is actually change into a digital representation of a dollar, which is probably less hit by inflation, and you can keep, and you have that safe, rather than actually, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, what you would have done in that scenario would have tried to swap it into actual fiat cash and hold it under your bank, stick it in the safe, under your bed and this kind of thing. This gives you a much better way to preserve your wealth. And then cross-border payments and remittances. You think about sort of how much it costs to send money and remittances back to countries and again, in Africa or LATAM from the UK. If you're an expat and you're trying to send money back, it can be extremely costly, extremely slow. And, you know, you hear reports of sort of maybe 10% of the amount that you want to send is actually taken up in foreign exchange fees and other fees associated. And the timing is very slow as well. It can be many, many days before the person at the other end, the family, gets the money that they want. Imagine, you know, a stablecoin that actually reduces that friction and improves the speed. These are very positive things.
I think you've touched on some very interesting points there. So first of all, stablecoins is existing outside the banking system, but they don't actually at the moment, do they? Not entirely, insofar that many stablecoins are actually backed by, or at least in part, by reserves that are held with commercial banks. And there's risk in that as well, I think, as we've seen in the example of Circle's holdings with USDC, when some of the banks at which it held reserves went down. That was a different type of risk that no one had really anticipated at that point. And so how can regulation play a role in ensuring the stability of stablecoins, especially if they're starting, you know, to be used outside the world of cryptocurrency trade settlement, if they're starting to be used more as a means of payments and transacting value for, you know, retail users and, you know, everyday people, you know, on the street? What role does regulation have to play in ensuring, you know, the stability of stablecoins and their reliability in these kind of everyday transactional use cases?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that there's two approaches to the question, depending on who you are and in which way that you're interacting with the stablecoin. If you are a person who's, say, in these previous examples that I've talked about, living effectively outside of the banking in infrastructure and maybe living in a high inflation environment, I would say that the stability of a stablecoin is very important to you. But if we think about what happened with Circle, there was a temporary depeg. And I wouldn't say it's a depeg. It was a lack of parity, a temporary lack of parity, because I think redeemability was still honored. I think that's an important concept. So the price on the secondary market went down because of the information that was coming out regarding the banking, that the reserves, that the element of the bank was the reserves that were held at the banks that then failed. So, and it sort of raises another interesting point, which I'm not sure most stablecoin people who interact with stablecoins recognize, is that it's a fully reserved product. It's different. So if you had money at a particular bank and that bank failed, you are covered up to a certain amount, you know, in various countries, your depository insurance and so on. And it's fractional. The deposit, you have a liability to the bank. The money you put in there is a liability, and they can lend, you know, up to 10 times its fractional reserve bank. With a stablecoin, it's actually for a fully reserved product. So it's generally accepted that, you know, for the coins that are in issue, always an equal amount, which actually makes, you could argue, safer than that. So obviously there's an element of the stablecoin, and you'd say that a stablecoin is as strong as its weakest bank, because ultimately, you know, the quality of where it leaves its bank deposits has a direct correlation to the stability of the price, because that's, you know, if it fails, that's what happened with Circle earlier in the year. But they resolved it. They resolved it, and it went down, and it was a depeg of, in terms of price, about 10%, you know, 13%, I think, at its most, and then it went back. So again, thinking back, if you're someone in Argentina, you had a product that was worth one, and it went down to 87, and then it went back to one. Not much has happened actually in your world. And actually, if it went down to 87, that's still actually a bit better than the currency that you would have held it in, because it would depreciate it by even more. So that's that, you know, it's not the best system, and I think it can be improved. And I think, you know, Circle and other stable coin issuers around the world will be helped by further clarity with regards to regulation in their various jurisdictions as to what they need to do with their stable coins. So I didn't mention, but GMO, the stablecoin business that I work for, GMO Trust, we are an NYDFS regulated stablecoin issuer. So we have a trust license and we issue 2 stablecoins and our supervisory agreement, a dollar stablecoin, yen stablecoin. But the reason I say that is we're actually mandated. There's a very clear prescription around what we're allowed to have in our reserves. It's the constituents of our reserves is prescribed by the NYDFS, and there was guidance, I think, in July of this year, quite clear as to what goes in there. Cash, short-term deposits, and it needs to be audited as well on a regular basis. So, you know, it's the attestations, the public domain, tell you what's actually going into your stable. We didn't answer the first bit. Sorry, I was rambling a little bit. But in terms of the whether we use it in when it starts to be used in financial services, so when it's competing with tokenized deposits, central bank, digital currencies, and it wants to be used as a recognized, robust financial instrument, financial settlement instrument, financial collateral, you know, these kind of things. There's no scope for DPEGs. There's no scope for, you know, you need finality. A bank's not going to be happy to have a product that they want to use as collateral that is wavering in its absolute value. So I think that's where clarity needs to be given as to the constituents and also maybe the proportions, assets and so on, so that there's more stability around those products, so that people in the financial industry can have more confidence when interacting with them.
I want to go back to something that you touched on about the difference between stable coins and commercial bank money or commercial bank deposits at the moment, because I think most people don't realize that when they take £100 or €100 in cash and they somehow miraculously manage to actually find a bank branch, walk into and deposit their cash, they no longer actually own £100 or €100. What they have is a claim against the bank for £100 or €100. And that claim against the bank is not backed by £100 in cash. It is backed by maybe £10 in cash and a lot of prudential regulation and financial services compensation scheme and, you know, love and trust and rainbows and a general, you know, confidence in the stability of the financial system that most people don't really pause to think about every day, except when something goes wrong. And then there will be a run on the bank, or people will start worrying about, you know, bank collapses and the extent to which they're protected by the financial services compensation scheme. And that is due to this, to commercial bank money being a product of fractional reserve banking. The bank takes your money and it uses it as leverage, basically, to create new deposits, which are based on fractional reserves. Whereas, as you said, with a stablecoin, it is fully asset backed. So it is a form of narrow, as a stablecoin issuer could be thought of as a form of narrow bank, really, in that it's only a deposit taking entity that then kind of converts those funds into safe, high quality liquid assets that are held somewhere that's trusted. And that's a fundamental difference, which I think brings us on to, you know, stablecoin commercial models. Banks can make money by, you know, the spreads between deposit taking and lending activities and things like that. How does a stablecoin issuer actually make money?
Good question. And yeah, I mean, just to sort of touch upon your point earlier, I agree. I mean, the reason it's relevant is because it's to do with the tokenized deposits and the other products that are coming out there. So the digital forms of money, but actually represent a credit risk against specific institutions. So, you know, if you bank with HSBC and I bank with Barclays, you know, we deposit the same £100, you know, we have a different risk profile depending on the institution that we bank with as to how safe our £100 is, depending on the activities of the underlying banks. And therefore, in bank run times, you know, I still vividly remember people queuing outside Northern Rock and so on in 2008 and, you know, Lehman's and all the rest of it. In that kind of time, you know, who you banked with mattered. And the activities of those banks mattered, you know, over and above the amount that you were due at the financial compensation scheme, which was about £85,000 or so. So it matters who you bank with. And this has transferred into the digital world with JP Morgan Coin, Citi Coin, and Gnome. A few banks will no doubt be offering their own products of some sort of in a digital format. And it's just important that people think that that has the same kind of risk attached, you know, the credit risk attached against those institutions. So I think you raised a really, really important point. And yeah, in terms of with stable coins, they're fully reserved. The idea is that they're fully reserved. They should be fully reserved. And therefore, yeah, they present the characteristics of, yeah, things that are closer to narrow banking. And as long as they are backed with high quality liquid assets, so I go back to the NYDFS, is prescriptive around cash, money market funds, reserve, you know, T-bills up to, you know, 90 days and so on. These are all high quality assets. So these are, you know, if you have a stablecoin that's backed with the reserves that have high quality assets in there, then you're in a good place. But I think it's another thing where this is quite a nascent industry. So whereas banking has had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years to think about quality legislation to protect consumers and consumers' interests and to define what counts as an arrow bank and what actors who operate in that space need to adhere to with regards to the reserves, with regards to the capitalization, with regards to many, many different sort of factors that should promote confidence in the whole system. I think we're still really early in the legislative journey for stablecoins and for digital money full stop. I think, you know, it's still, we're still really only getting clarity. And it's only really been this year when we're starting to get things in the UK, where we're starting to get things in Singapore. MiCA's, of course, come out. But, you know, the states are still discussing these stablecoin bill hasn't come through yet. And it's still a heavily politicized part of the world at the moment and a heavily politicized subject matter. So, you know, it will take a bit more time for us to get the relevant clarity, I think, that will get true institutional adoption. But I do think that we've reached a tipping point where people are starting to get more comfortable with the product. You're starting to get more nice guidance from the FSB and on global cooperation. IOSCO is starting to look at some of this stuff as well. So we're moving in the right direction.
I think what's really interesting as well is that the regulators have an incredible amount of power over the future success of stablecoins and the shape that the stablecoin market and industry will take, because essentially they have the power to make or break it depending on the extent to which stable coins can be put in an even footing when it comes to trust and confidence and the regulatory structures that are in place to support that in the minds of the general public. But first, I mean, regulators, I think up till now, have been rather wary of stable coins, haven't they? And in part, this is due to the most infamous stablecoin that never, ever came to see the light of day, which was then Facebook's proposals around what was then Libra. How do you think that those proposals kind of affected the way that regulators and central banks perceive the risks associated with stablecoins versus the potential benefits that they might offer to consumers?
Well, also, I think with regards...
Just a tiny question.
Thanks for that. On a Monday morning, we throw that ball in. Okay. But I think it's a really good question. And I think Libra is a product of its time. And I say that in the sense that it's not... When you look at the distinctions of what Libra stood for at the time, it's not that different to what stablecoins are offering now. The problem was that it was so early in the evolution of sort of digital money, the crypto ecosystem, that, and because of the nature of who was proposing it, you know, Facebook, massive audience with sort of 2 billion people around the world using its products, it had a real threat factor to global policymakers and central banks. It could disrupt policy. It could take the ability to, I guess the central banks and the governments around the world were thinking, we could be disrupted by this product. This product actually could really suck out all that money out of our circulating supply and put it into effectively a private company. And I think at the time that was a novel concept and extremely scary. And hence, I think it was shut down very early. Well, it was shut down effectively. It was just, we can't deal with this. Let's stop it. We're going to ban it and let's deal with some other things. Fast forward 5 years and we have the largest cryptocurrency at the moment. So our largest stable coin is Tether, which it doesn't adhere or isn't regulated by a particular jurisdiction. It's trusted by the market. It's about $85 billion worth. People are able to redeem and people are able to trade it. And ironically, it traded at a premium when Circle, which was a stablecoin which wished to engage with the world, with the regulated world, had its sort of lack of parity. So we talk about what's trusted by the market and do you need to be regulated? Do you need to have regulatory sort of approval in order, does that equal market confidence? And generally the line is yes, but not always. And at the moment we saw a point where actually the product that was anti-establishment, anti-regulation was more trusted by the crypto community and the markets, but you know, so that was quite interesting, I think.
Which is not necessarily really a message that regulators want to hear.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a bit about the stablecoin standard organization and your work on that, what you're trying to achieve with that.
Sure. So the stablecoin standard is an organization that represents the interests of stablecoin issuers globally, and not just the issuers, the whole ecosystem. And I guess I should clarify, it's predominantly for fiat-backed stablecoin issues that are regulated. So that's sort of, we have some entry criteria, and those are the two that are prominent. So you need to be fiat-backed and regulated where possible in the jurisdiction that you issue your stablecoin from. So with those provisos, I realized sort of coming out of TradFi and there being numerous organizations, either at an individual level or at a corporate level, that represented, you know, industry bodies, effectively FX industry bodies, the ACI, you know, and they could, you know, they could do the global code of foreign exchange and so on. You know, there are lots of ways that the industry was able to self-police itself, promote best practice, but also engage with regulators to create good legislation. And I saw that how that was working in TradFi when I came into the stablecoin part of our business. I realized that there actually wasn't a trade union, a group that represented stablecoin issues. And I was thinking this seems an anomaly because stablecoins are the closest instrument to financial services. They're the ones that lowest hanging fruit from a regulatory framework. They're the ones where they're getting cited specifically in regulation. But yet there doesn't seem to be a global body, and they're global by definition, you know. And of course, the majority of the market cap out of stablecoins is dollar stablecoins, but there are other currency stablecoins out there from a wide jurisdictional framework, and they weren't being represented. So what started as a sort of best practice Telegram group between a few of us just grew and grew, and we decided to formalize it earlier this year. So we've got 16 issuer members, we have 17 different currencies presented, we have the ecosystem represented as well through our advisory support, and so it's you know, layer ones, layer twos, custody providers, venues, centralized exchanges, and so on. People who are subject matter experts in their parts of the ecosystem. I think it's really important that we bring all together under the tent, as it were, so we can actually think about best practice. How do we sort of police ourselves? How do we actually think about where legislation is heading globally? And the nice thing is we've got perspective from different issues who are based in different places. So we've got a Singaporean stablecoin issuer who's based in Singapore. So of course they've got subject matter expertise of the MAS framework. We've got people who are EU regulators, so they can chime in with what Mika's doing. You know, we've got US regulated stablecoin issues from the States. So it's nice. We bring a holistic approach to this. And I think, you know, the narrative in stablecoins has been dominated by a couple of companies, and they have the different agenda and they don't necessarily have the global perspective. So we think that the stablecoin standards can actually bring a bit more sort of perspective to the conversation and bring actual subject matter expertise from a variety of regions to grow the power of stablecoins, to show the use cases, to educate regulators, and and as a result, hopefully get best practice and therefore a good outcome for consumers who may wish to engage with stablecoins in the coming years.
That sounds fantastic, Ravi. So basically a global trade association and kind of policy advocacy representative organization for stablecoin issuers and those in the ecosystem, and one also with an ongoing role to play as different regulatory frameworks, hopefully not too different, given the nature of stablecoins, start to evolve and develop around the world as well.
Indeed.
So let's look ahead, maybe finish off with your kind of look into the future of stablecoins. First of all, we've chatted very briefly about the term stablecoin. And as you know, and as many of our listeners know, I hate the term stablecoin at the moment. I think it was a very useful term in the early days of these kind of new forms of digital money. But as on that kind of private issuance side of the spectrum, different models have developed and they look like very different things. And they will likely be regulated and treated as potentially quite different things, though whether they should or shouldn't is probably a whole other conversation to be had. How do you see these things that are currently all classed as stablecoins evolving, fitting into the wider ecosystem of money in general and generally becoming part of that ecosystem of money?
There's a lot of questions wrapped up in that question. So I guess the first thing around the terminology and taxonomy, so stablecoins, is that the best term for these products? Probably not. Maybe asset reference tokens is probably a bit closer. Having said that, that is the label that supranational organizations, the FSB, you know, they call it a Global Stablecoin Collective, I think, but GSC. So they call it stablecoin. DMAS calls it a stablecoin. The bill that's getting proposed in the States is called stablecoin bill. So unfortunately, this is the label that has stuck to represent the tokens that these things represent at the moment. Could that evolve over time? Probably. No, I think as the industry matures, there'll probably be a more appropriate terminology used and label applied. But I think that needs education at sort of at the regulatory stage first before that becomes commonplace. I think we're going to be stuck with the label stablecoin to represent the products that I certainly offer and advocate on for the near term. In terms of where are they heading with regards to widespread adoption and the future of stablecoins, I think there's a lot of scope for change. I think change in terms of the participants that are in the industry sort of issuing stablecoins from various parts of the world. You know, at the moment, there's the majority are private stablecoin issuers who don't have experience in banking, or they're not banks issuing, so they're private companies. You know, so there's a private company, hasn't been a bank before or done anything. Same with Paxos and a few of the other larger spaces. Tether is just a self entity at the moment. I can see more banks issuing stablecoins. I know that NAB and a few of the Australians have issued stablecoins. I think that SocGen has a Forge product stablecoin. I think we'll see more of that because I think they see the value of the product. And I think they also see it as sufficiently different to tokenized deposit. So
I was going to ask about that. Yes, for a bank, the utility and value in issuing a stablecoin as opposed to tokenized deposit.
Yeah, well, I think they serve slightly different purposes. So I think for me, a tokenized deposit is a fantastic way to use the technology to allow intra-bank customers to transfer value to each other efficiently, safely, quickly. But it can't be used outside of the walled garden. Whereas if a bank issues a stable coin, then that allows for international applicability outside of the walled garden. That's actually much more powerful, in my opinion. So I think that'll be interesting.
Because a stablecoin is a bearer instrument.
It's a digital bearer instrument. Yeah. So that's it's not a claim against a specific amount that's in, you know, the particular bank, like a deposit token. This is a bearer instrument. So there's a segregated reserve pool that is against it that someone can redeem, but you can give that. I can give you 10, you know, SocGen euros, you know, euro stablecoin or whatever, and that's yours now, and you can give it to someone else outside the system, and neither of us need to bank with SocGen in order to participate in this exchange of value. So that's a very interesting thing. So I think more banks will start to issue stablecoins. I think that the technology is still new. So I think that potentially some institutions will become stablecoin white label distributors. The technology itself will be sort of harmonized and distributed via white label offerings. I think there'll be potentially, depending on how CBDCs develop, you may have stable coins that in their reserve pool are backed by CBDCs. That could be an interesting outlook as well. So to have a complete, you know, digital money reference in one particular product. Yeah, I think the future is very, very bright. There's a lot of interesting use cases inside and outside the banking infrastructure to promote the growth of stable coins. And I think the participants that are there at the moment may not necessarily be the participants in the next 5 years.
Thanks, Rami. I think we could talk about this all morning and probably over many, many drinks in the future. But it's been great having you on. Thank you so much for your insights on this. And hopefully we'll be seeing you in the stablecoin standard a lot more in the future at our DPF events and things like that, as you are soon to be our partners.
Yes, I wasn't sure whether we could mention that. So yes, thank you very, very much for your time today. I think, yes, we could talk about this for hours and hours and days and days. So, and I'm sure we will. But yes, thank you very much. And yeah, very, very pleased to be a partner of the Digital Pound Foundation, a stablecoin standard. This is a very exciting time for us. And look forward to many joint events in the future.